everyone, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your host today, Juliet Liu, coming to you from Berkeley, California. Before we start, I wanted to remind our listeners to follow us on social media. So feel free to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod, where we post the latest news, research, and debates on China's Belt and Road Initiative. The Mekong River was famous throughout history for defying efforts to tame it. French colonial explorers and many others before and after them exhausted themselves trying to find navigable paths for larger transport and have failed. Today, the Mekong River runs through one of the most biologically and culturally diverse, but also rapidly changing regions in the world. From its source in the Tibetan Plateau, it flows through China, constitutes the borders between Myanmar, Thailand, and Laos, and then flows through Cambodia and out to sea through the Vietnam Delta. An enormous and dynamic group of people rely on this river. But today, many new developments, most prominently the plan to establish a number of hydropower dams, threatened to tame the mighty Mekong. Chinese hydropower technology, capital, and political influence are major drivers of hydropower development on the Mekong. It's a form of Chinese investment that long predates the Belt and Road, but it constitutes one of the top flows of Chinese capital into the region and has laid the groundwork for other Belt and Road Initiative projects. Here to talk about the river's history and the current day resource politics surrounding the Mekong River's change is Brian Eiler. Brian is a senior fellow and director of the Stimson Center's Southeast Asia Program. Brian is an expert on transboundary issues in the Mekong region, and he specializes in Chinese economic cooperation with Southeast Asia. He's spent more than 15 years living and working in China, and over the last 10 years, he's conducted extensive research with stakeholders in the Mekong region. Brian is also the co-founder of the influential website eastbysoutheast.com, which I've used a number of times, and he's here to talk to us today about his excellent book, The Last Days of the Mighty Mekong, which just came out last year. Brian, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
It's great to be here, Juliet.
So first, you've had a fascinating kind of path to this work. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up working for the Stimson Center and how you became interested in hydropower politics in the Mekong region?
Sure. It is an interesting path. It's kind of a long path to Washington that went from a childhood in central Pennsylvania all the way to China, where I lived for 15 years and worked for much of that time and began to think about China's rise, its relationship with Southeast Asia, with particular focus on the Mekong River. So like 15 years ago, I was taking rides down the river on cargo ships with Chinese government officials, tracing their products, some business people as well, tracing products as they're going downstream to market in Bangkok. It was one of the first times that this could happen, like the cases of broccoli could go from Kunming in southwest China all the way down the river and then be packed onto a truck and make it to markets in Bangkok. And during that experience, which was a graduate school experience, I also got to visit some of China's big dams on the Mekong and see them as they were being built. And originally, my interest was to learn more about the commercial and trade and investment increase between China and Southeast Asia. But when you see those dams and you think about their upstream impacts on downstream areas, it's hard to remove them from your memory. And I think your mind began to think about how these pieces of infrastructure are going to impact downstream communities. And that led later to a path of research that turned into a path of making policy recommendations from afar in Kunming for various stakeholders in the region and the U.S. government. And I said, hey, I think this is something that I can do better from Washington, D.C., and found a job that supported that motivation. And here I am in Washington. And we spent a lot of our work informing the U.S. government as well as other development partners and governments in the region on smarter policies and alternative plans for building out infrastructure in the Mekong region.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit more. I found this so fascinating. I mean, the Stimson Center, I usually think of as a U.S.-focused think tank. But you were saying, when you spoke at Berkeley like a couple months ago, that hydropower politics in the Mekong region are increasingly seen by the Stimson Center and by U.S. policymakers as fitting into Stimson's kind of goal of promoting security and prosperity. So in what way are hydropower politics in the Mekong interesting to people in D.C.?
Yeah, I do get this often, that when I tell people here in the U.S. that I work on hydropower issues and energy and water issues in Southeast Asia, they say, oh, there are people in Washington, D.C. that are interested in that. And certainly there are.
Yeah, right.
And have been for a long time. The Stimson Center's Southeast Asia program was working on Mekong issues long before I came on board. And it was led by Dr. Richard Cronin and his efforts to, I guess, bridge the science policy gap and to expose risks to what countries in the Mekong were doing to the river and its mighty natural resource base. And that's something that got Stimson on the map in terms of this Mekong discourse, as well as open channels for dialogue between government stakeholders in the region and government stakeholders here in Washington, D.C. And within those risks, you know, you have to respond to risks. And the U.S. has a lot of tools in its toolbox that can be applied to reducing risk and improving food security outcomes and water security outcomes and energy security outcomes in the region. And at the same time, we have to remember that these countries, many of them, see the U.S. as a key partner. You know, Thailand being a treaty ally of the United States, Vietnam increasingly becoming more and more of a strategic partner for the United States, and that partnership strengthens on a daily basis.
Which is strange considering the history, but is that partly because Vietnam is trying to distance itself from China?
I think that's a big part of it, okay. And these countries in Southeast Asia are always playing a balancing game, if you will. You know, none of them is too large that it can be the main power within the region, and certainly others act so that no one single country can do that. So the countries tend to be outward oriented, and they look to create deeper relationships with the superpowers and larger economic powers, and also try their best over periods of time not to fall too far into one country's pocket. And so we see this balancing act playing out over and over again. So there's times where these countries are more oriented towards the deepening U.S. engagement, and they're articulating their needs more clearly to the U.S. And in fact, I think we're in one of those times right now. So right. Our methods of engagement are particularly being called upon now to promote alternative development options in the Mekong Basin.
So when we think of the Mekong region, it's interesting because Yunnan province counts as part of the Mekong. So that's China's piece of the region, right? And then it works down through Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. You have this right. Kind of mainland Southeast Asia block. Talk a little bit maybe about the political tensions that you show in the book. How is hydropower development along the Mekong driven by tensions with China? And why are China and hydropower development so linked in this region? Right.
Well, I mean, the discourse, the shallowest discourse on the Mekong is one of China and the Mekong, or China's dams in the Mekong, and that China is the big upstream superpower with 11 of the largest dams in the world. That's true, built on the Mekong, and half of the Mekong's length is in China. So whatever China does upstream will have profound effects downstream, and the rest of the countries are pure victims and passive in this process and need the rest of the world to come to their rescue to solve problems. I think, again, that's a very shallow discourse. Certainly China's upstream dams can have profound impacts on the river system below, particularly now because there's a drought playing out in the Mekong Basin, and it's probably the worst drought that has ever occurred there. Mm-hmm. And it's a result of a weather pattern as well as the incremental impacts of dams. During times of drought, when there's very little rainfall in the system, China's portion can actually contribute 50% of the water volume in the river. So that does suggest, you know, what China's dams do and how much water it holds back and how much other things those dams hold back, like fish migration pathways as well as sediment, impacts the downstream in a profound way. But at the same time, Laos has already 60 dams built on its portion of the river, and there's something like 60 more under construction, with hundreds more in the works. Some of them are invested by Chinese construction companies. Thailand's investing in 2 times as many of what China is investing in the region. And then Cambodia is under a lot of pressure to build out its own energy sector to meet its own domestic energy demand needs. And there is some pressure to push hydropower forward there. And China certainly has an MOU on one of the largest dams that could kill the entire Mekong ecosystem if what has already been built hasn't already done that. And then we have the Mekong Delta downstream, which borders the ocean and is a large patch of land that is about the size of West Virginia, but it has a lot, many more people on it, about 19 million people living in the Mekong Delta. And it's one of Vietnam's most important agricultural and economic zones. And the lack of water in the system in the Delta, even though that it's thousands of kilometers away from China, is reducing agricultural production, is having economic impact there. And certainly during these times of drought, China's dams impact economic outcomes and social outcomes in the Mekong Delta.
Yeah, and that's something I want to circle back to at the end of our conversation, because you've been commenting in media recently on this. I mean, you mentioned the weather patterns in the region. Most of Southeast Asia has this experience of monsoonal kind of seasonal patterns, right? So it's the winter is the dry season. For many months, you can go without rain or with much drier patterns. The summertime usually, or at least the North America summertime, is kind of the monsoon rains come. And this year has been far from what I understand the rainfall, but also just all the way down the stream, it's just much less water on the Mekong.
This year has been extremely abnormal.
And an
El Nino weather pattern hit in June of last year. So we're already, 7 months past when the initial symptoms started to appear. And instead of raining all summer long, for 4 or 5 months, the region only got 2 or 3 big rains, which is extremely abnormal. And now, again, we've transitioned into the dry season that will persist until May or June if the monsoons return. So there's really no relief coming to the region. And already parts of Vietnam, parts of Cambodia, parts of Thailand have declared emergency drought conditions. Vietnam being the most recent, with Ben Chai province declaring that this week.
Right, exactly. China was the first one to put dams on the Mekong. And you make a careful distinction between mainstream dams and dams that are on the rivers that feed to the Mekong. But
sure.
You make the point that dams feeding into the Mekong are just as important flow and for nutrients and things like that. But we often focus mostly on the mainstream dams. China was the first to build on the mainstream. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. The first dam at Man Wan in Yunnan province was built in the early 90s.
So first we have the early 90s. And then when was then you talk about the Mekong River Commission. And I know that's something that's a fascinating story, because, the Mekong River Commission, or the MRC, it was the hope of a lot of people internationally that this would be one of the first commissions, the first kind of international regional bodies that would be able to organize around environmental and social concerns around development across multiple countries, right? So there was a big hope when it was established. Can you tell us the story that you've walked throughout the book of the MRC and how it started out and how it has developed into what it is today?
Yeah, I think you're right to say there was a moment in the mid 90s where globally there was applause for Southeast Asia over the achievements of setting up the Mekong Agreement, which is an international treaty, a transboundary water management treaty that set up the Mekong River Commission. So we go back to that time. Again, it's the mid-90s. The Cold War has ended. The Vietnamese-Cambodian conflict has ended. Vietnam leaves Cambodia. And that was kind of the building block for Southeast Asia that could really bring these countries together once again, or maybe for the first time. I would say for the first time, not once again. And then China turns on one of its first dams. And when these dams are built upstream, downstream portions of the river are tamed or regulated. So much so, as the thinking went at that time, that the downstream portions could then have dams on them. And those dams could provide electricity for domestic needs as well as for export. And so again, it was all of that coming together that sent a signal to these countries to say the Mekong River is finally ready for development. Because there had been pressures to build dams on the river for the previous half century, with the U.S. leading the way during the Vietnam War period, actually. We can get into that story if you're interested, or you can check it out in my book. But so with the concern and with a lot of knowledge in their hands that dams will impact the downstream areas. Dams will reduce economic outcomes in the Mekong Delta. Dams will undo the ecology of the Tonle Sap Lake in Cambodia, which is the highest yielding freshwater fishery in the world from one body of water. That knowledge was known, and a discourse was set that then development of the river needs to go forward carefully. And there was an expectation that it would. And a lot of focus from these countries was placed on mainstream dams. And as time passes, perhaps that focus placed too much attention to mainstream dams.
Right.
So much so that the tributaries begun to get built out. I mean, I talked to a professor at Berkeley after my talk a few months ago who said no one in the 90s at the MRC thought that Laos would build out 60 tributary dams.
Yeah.
You know, everyone thought the mainstream dams would come first. And mm-hmm. and now there's one on that crosses the entirety of the mainstream. There's one on a portion of the mainstream. And there are over 100 on tributaries right. in the Mekong.
One of the things that your book does really well is show kind of some of the hypocrisies across political tensions as you move down the Mekong that you see. I mean, you mentioned already, right, that Thailand has some of the most active anti-dam activists, but it also has,
right.
it also buys most of the energy that's coming, at least out of Laos, from what I understand, from Lao hydropower
sure.
dams, right? So you have Thailand in a strange position, and then you have, even recently, like Vietnam doesn't even have a clear anti-dam, pro-dam stance, right? Tell us a little bit about the political tensions for each of the countries in terms of
right.
wanting dams versus being worried about the impacts.
Well, domestically in Thailand, the political and the economic structure is set to promote building dams outside of Thailand. And so there's the promotion of gross inefficiencies in Thailand that reward elite at the top. I mean, I think that's the simplest way to say it. And this is one of the reasons why the exteriors of malls like Siam Paragon in Bangkok, the most Instagram place on earth, by the way, are air conditioned. The exteriors of these malls are air conditioned. And there are malls in Bangkok that consume more electricity than far flung provinces of Thailand, single malls.
Right.
And they continue to go up, and each of them is essentially linked to a dam. You can really think of it that way. And the dam is located in Laos, far away, hundreds of kilometers away. And there is an elite system that continues to be rewarded for building more projects abroad. And there's very little coming down the pike right now, even with options of solar, wind, and biomass coming online in Thailand. Very few options look like they can shake that system. We will see. Because it's a system that doesn't pay off economically. You know, you're increasing supply of electricity and demand is rising somewhat, but the price of electricity isn't going down, right? So like economics aren't working here, and maybe someday they will. You know, maybe people will be fed up with paying more and more for their electricity, even though they're getting, you know, more and more access to electricity. In Vietnam, it's a very different situation. Vietnam also needs to electrify, you know, the territory of Vietnam and meet demand for increasing urbanization, industrialization. But the Vietnamese, for the longest time, even though Vietnam has built dams on the upstream portions of its portions of the Mekong in the central highlands and lots of dams in the north, Vietnam has vehemently and collectively across government, across civil society, across academia and researchers, opposed upstream mainstream dams. Until this year, when a dam on the mainstream of the Mekong in Laos near Luang Prabang was announced, the Luang Prabang Dam, that has a significant portion of ownership for a Vietnamese construction company, and that company will likely build the dam. So this is something very strange that is happening. It's worth exploring. But just to come back to Thailand, very quickly, despite that political system, that a rigged political system that rewards those who build dams abroad, there are very active civil society groups, particularly along the Mekong, who have opposed dams, who have taken those dam developers, the Thai dam developers, to court. They've never won, but
right.
it gets their voices up there in the media and in the global media as well. And I think, interestingly, this Thai government is now beginning to respond to the needs of those local communities the Thai government this week filed a complaint to China over upstream control of its dams on water and how that's directly impacting these riverside communities along the mainstream.
One of the amazing things about your book, and I think it's a product of your intimate relationship with the region before you started working back in Washington, but you did so much travel, making personal connections and hearing individual stories along the Mekong as you were working in Kunming.
Right.
And you start off the book with this iconic figure, the iconic in my mind of, is he Kru Ti? Is that how you say it?
Right, Kru Ti.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the opening that you have. In my mind, he's emblematic of this very specific point of view where he's sitting downstream from the Chinese dams, looking at the Chinese trading boats that are coming by and the speedboats that are setting off explosives to clear the river for passage, right? It's this moment when Chinese different actors are taming the river in a way. Yeah, talk about him a little bit and why he struck you as the perfect opening for the book and why it's important to have these ground level perspectives.
Well, he's a successful activist and convener of grassroots stakeholders in the region. In the region around where he lives and works in the Golden Triangle, but also within the region at large. So in many ways, he's my Mekong role model. He's the person I go to for advice. And he's been successful because he maintains that connection to communities. He promotes the cultural values of the area around him. He brings in the need to reward rather than take away, you know, the benefits of what the river is providing to communities by some downstream project. You know, his message is that if development is going to happen in an area around us, then it needs to benefit the area around us. And that just isn't happening in that part of the world. And so at the same time, he shows the struggles and that the farmers, the fishers are going through in the Golden Triangle. And it shows how they work together to develop practices to help them cope and adapt with these ever-changing impacts that hit them year on year. Mm-hmm. And while they do that, they can say that they're thriving despite all the challenges. They're finding ways to continue and promote a way of life that is unique to the Mekong. And that's why, again, he's my Mekong hero.
I think later in the book, there's a moment where you actually profile two different Chinese people working in Laos, I think. One is a chief of Chinese engineering. He's overseeing dams around the Namu mm-hmm. River. And he tells you that Chinese laborers are willing to work harder and they're much more reliable than Lao people. What's more, Lao people ask for higher wages. And he's scandalized by this. And then just lower on that page, you have this other Chinese guy that you meet. He's someone who came from Hunan. And if you work in that region, people might know that Shishuangbanna has a huge Hunanese population. So this guy is probably from Hunan in the 1990s, but with ties probably, I'm assuming, through Shishuangbanna, just north of Laos. And he talks about how the Lao pace of life is sabai sabai, which is an easy, slow, let things happen as they will attitude. And so you give a really important sense of the diversity of Chinese actors in the region. But then I think those two examples bring out a tension of, is China inserting itself unilaterally into the rest of the Mekong, or is it engineering a brand new future defined by China for the Mekong region, or is it integrating itself into the region? You know, do you see China as pushing its will into this area and winning out?
Well, it's really complex. And I think that, I mean, I hate to be stereotypical, but a lot of China's culture is hierarchical. And whether it's through the family or through government or through a view of the world, right, where countries are developing, countries are developed. I mean, the language is pretty clear in Chinese. And then there are generations of people who have seen, you know, China go from the planned economy to its current state. And they feel there's a real success story there. So again, I don't want to stereotype for everyone, but I think it's common for Chinese people who have grown up through that experience to go to the region and say, we can help out here. You know, we can help you build tall buildings. We can help engineer your rivers, and we can do it the way we did it because it worked for us. I've heard Chinese people in northern Thailand say, where are all the tall buildings? You know, this is such a backward area. We need some tall buildings here, something like that. And certainly there are more coming. But that type of mentality, rarely is there a chance, well, increasingly more and more, but is there a chance for locals to have a dialogue, those coming in and observing things this way and say, well, you know, that's not the way we see it. And there are a few chances, I would say, outside of the elite arena for Chinese investors or Chinese commercial interests or, you know, Chinese think tank leaders going to the region to say, you know, how would you like this done? Because certainly, I mean, there are drivers for development in all of these countries, and the drivers are quite different. I think where China runs into trouble, or Chinese people run into trouble, is when there's a cookie cutter common model placed toward different sectors. And then the change comes not through dialogue. It comes from a learning by doing process. And often, you know, there are these backlashes and or adjustments that have to be made. And certainly we've seen people, Chinese people, change. And so that the reason why I chose those two, one is that it did show that there was a Chinese immigrant who moved to Laos and who really got into the culture. And he talked about being disaffected by his life in China. So he married a Lao woman and really prefers life and a family and a livelihood in Laos. I really can't say that I've met a lot of people like that recently, like living in Cambodia, Chinese people living in Cambodia or in northern Thailand, or even moving to Laos. And in fact, most of the people that I talk to, and I do this quite often, walking through markets or restaurants, they say, yeah, we're going to make some money here and pack up and go in 10 years. Whether that happens or not is a different story.
Right. I think, yeah, I definitely have seen you have multiple generations coming in, and the generation coming in recently is a lot more business focused, less culturally embedded, which is not, yeah, again, not the case for all, but there's definitely multiple generations. And when people first come in, they might have much clearer objectives for getting in and out than people who have been there for a while.
Yeah. I mean, people come for different reasons. You know, some are there to build high-speed rail. Some are there to build dams. Others are running markets and setting up restaurants. And, you know, if we look at this type of activity of people movement to the region, it's been happening for hundreds of years. Right? This isn't something new. I think it was the bamboo curtain that stopped the population flow. I think at the level that we're seeing it now, was more of an exception than the rule. But certainly I would argue that the volume and the mass of investment, as well as of new people coming from China into the Mekong region, can be overwhelming to certain sectors, and can feel overwhelming to people, Cambodians in Phnom Penh, certainly for Cambodians in Sihanoukville. We're seeing this play out in the media more and more as time progresses.
Yeah, my friend Chris Horton just did a great piece in The Atlantic on Sihanoukville. And the last person that we had on this podcast that just came out in our episode a couple weeks ago was also Lily Pike, was talking about Cambodian energy investments and mentioning, you know, the demand for energy in Sihanoukville growing. But you also have this amazing case of the Shukaku deal in Phnom Penh.
Right.
Walk us through that one. It's one of my favorite projects in the book. And it's, from what I understand it started a couple years before the Belt and Road was even announced, but it's so emblematic of, I think, some of the bigger projects you see unfolding these days.
So this is a story of a lake that no longer exists in the middle of Phnom Penh. And it was the city's largest lake. There are stories of Hun Sen, the prime minister of Cambodia, how he would go there in the 90s and drink whiskey along the lakeside and enjoy the lake's breeze on those hot, balmy Phnom Penh evenings. But in 2007, an announcement came through that the lake itself was going to be developed into a real estate project. And, you know, how do you develop a body of water in the middle of a city into a real estate project? And the answer was pump a lot of sand in from the Mekong to fill it in and to, you know, erase it, history and memory from the city. 4,500 households were living along the lakeside or on the lake, and many of them were some of the city's poorest people. And many of them had been moving around for decades through all the turmoil of Cambodia's history of the last 70 years. And they were told to move overnight. And some had claims, some felt they had claims and deeds to their property. They were told that those deeds were all illegal. Over time, land reform changes happened in Cambodia. Some of these individuals were granted deeds to their land. Others who were not given these rights protested. Protests happened from day one. And in fact, the company that came in to develop the lake was called Shukaku. And the protesters originally took their protests to the Korean embassy because they thought it sounded like a Korean name. That's how non-transparent this project was, right? And it turns out it was a Chinese-backed company from Ordos in Inner Mongolia. And over time, protests, clashes, violence, people jailed, people forced to sign off on giving up their lands through a variety of nefarious means. Most of the 4,500 households were kicked off their land, and now they live in resettlement areas around the city, or they're, you know, just making ends meet wherever they could settle. A small portion of those households were granted land and the ability to build new homes where they used to live, and the lake's gone. It's just this ugly patch of land with Chinese-looking xiaochu built on them, and this important cultural and ecological body of water for Phnom Penh has disappeared.
Yeah, and there's a number of these fascinating stories, right? That what I like about that one also is that in the book you kind of break down the way it unfolds from the community's perspective is fascinating. This idea that they don't even know what company is coming in, and that the company is much more tied to Cambodian elites. If the interests driving it are unclear, but it seems so visible, especially how close it was to Phnom Penh. It's remarkable. But throughout the book, right. I mean, I would really encourage all the listeners to go through it. It's been praised as being a really incredible look at the ecological side, the social side of hydropower development, but also a really good way of documenting how China moves into another region through the specificities of the hydropower sector. It's a great read, and that's really both enjoyable and extremely informative. There was also, I'm interested in your ideas of the future, right? So it profiles the MRC a bit, which we touched on. Something it doesn't go into is the Lansang Mekong Cooperative Initiative. And this is something you and I talked about a bit, I think, last time we spoke. China kind of trying to put out its own facade of promoting cooperation on its own terms? Or how do you read the Lansang Mekong Cooperation Initiative?
Sure. Well, Lansang Mekong Cooperation Initiative or mechanism was just getting kicked off whenever I was wrapping up research on this book. And we know a lot more about it now. I mean, it's interesting. It was announced in late 2016, really became fleshed out in 2018. This is a dialogue mechanism. I know it's kind of a political term, but right, it's a way for speaking, for China to speak. Yeah, in a multilateral way to the countries of the lower Mekong. So this is a game changer. It's new. China's diplomatic approach is typically not to take up multilateral initiatives, right. You know, focus on bilateral dialogues, bilateral investment projects and approaches, et cetera. And this one is, there are several activities inside of it that get the countries together talking to each other. So there's a water dialogue that happens at the high level. That has a high-level summit attached to it, and that comes through China's Ministry of Water Resources. And there's a think tank dialogue that is supposed to be outside of government, but many of the think tanks are attached to government, not just in China and this think tank network, but also in Vietnam and Myanmar. So it is a platform where countries could voice their concerns about water resource issues. But a close colleague of mine hosted one of these dialogues in northern Thailand a few months ago and said, you know, we'd love to talk about the water issue. I mean, this is when this drought is playing out right in front of them. But water is too sensitive to bring up with the Chinese counterparts. So we're going to talk about ecotourism. And that's part of the problem. You know, there is a platform there that's not being utilized to do what it was oriented to do, or to promote outcomes that could be beneficial for downstream countries. Mm. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi called it, saying it's not going to be some talk shop that just talks about things, that this is going to bulldoze the region and bulldoze the region. And that scared a lot of people, I believe. But the idea was that there'll be multiple sectoral approaches: energy, water, trade, investment, transportation, Belt and Road,
right.
connectivity, that, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions, if not more, of dollars will be pumped into to promote cooperation and to build projects to help these countries develop.
Do you think that statement was
a Chinese way?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And do you think that statement was a poor translation, or do you think it was, to bulldoze the region is a visual?
Yeah, it's kind of scary, a scary image. But the Mekong River Commission recently signed an MOU for cooperation with the LMC.
Right.
So we're seeing something for the MRC to dialogue with, that there's a physical platform, and that never existed before. Mm-hmm. And that they're actually talking about substantive issues like sharing data on water releases from upstream dams, which is critically important for, I think, from an MRC perspective, for both being able to send information to downstream dams on what's coming down the river, but then also how to better understand how China's operations impact livelihoods downstream, which is an expressed interest of the Mekong River Commission. What we didn't see was a deep discussion of the drought.
And yeah, right.
that struck me as surprising.
So when you talk about the drought, and this has been in the news a lot recently, and with mostly people reaching out to you because you know a lot about it, it's hard to sort out, right, what's China's fault or how China is to blame in general for having dams so far upstream. To what extent are those dams influencing the or exacerbating the drought situation? But there's also this narrative that when China was putting the dams in, they said, you know, this will be useful in the case of extreme weather events. Being able to control the flows will be beneficial to everyone. So how do we see that? Is it China's fault? To what extent could they help ease the difficulties that downstream countries are experiencing? How does that work on a kind of technical level?
China pitched a narrative to the downstream countries that you can now develop the river because our dams will regulate the flow of the river by taming it in the monsoon season and providing more water during the dry season.
Right.
Now, that we can talk about why that's a really bad idea for the Mekong ecosystem, because it's one that thrives on floods and the dramatic shift from dry to wet each year. But China's never made good on that. China's dams have never regulated the river in such a fashion that in a predictable way reduces monsoon flows and increases water during the dry season.
By choice is what you're saying, not because they don't have the technology to do it, but because it would change their ability to make reliable energy.
Well, it's just that the needs of those dams in China are precluding that outcome.
Right.
So from happening, these dams in China actually are operating in a very erratic way. You know, one might think of a dam as always producing electricity, but that's not the case for Yunnan's dams. And they have really never produced much electricity at all. And they're peaking dams, so they're called upon, their electricity is called upon at high times of high peak need.
Right.
Which is rare. So that means that the river is being shocked, right? Mm-hmm. With water running through its turbines in a very erratic manner. So if you look at the hydrographs, those are the graphs that show change in river level along the mainstream, just below China's most downstream dam. The hydrograph looks like a Tesla stock chart, up and down, and just crazy ups and crazy downs. We're waiting for when you air this, who knows where a Tesla stock chart would be. But that's not regulation, right? That's erratic shocks to the river system.
Right.
So at a time when China, like now, when China's portion of the river is contributing a significant amount of the water, and those dams are being called upon in that way, then the shocks are even more pronounced to the downstream areas, and they penetrate farther and farther downstream. They're felt farther and farther downstream.
Incredible. Your description of the river as something that actually has to ebb and flow. You talk about the Tonle Sap in Cambodia being like the beating heart of the river. It's not a river that just constantly trickles at the same rate, right? It's a living, breathing thing, which I think is why this idea of the Mekong River as being mighty is so important. So just to wrap up and give a few concluding thoughts, I mean, the title of your book is Last Days of the Mighty Mekong, right? So in what sense is the Mekong fully tamed now? What is your view for the region going forward and the life of the river now that it has some hydropower development on it, but moving forward, it'll still be this dynamic force of lifeblood in the region. What do you see for the future of the Mekong?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's been tamed because climate change effects are impacting it now. So this is something that planners weren't accounting for. These dams that have been built are running at much lower levels of efficiency than they were thought to produce. So they're not meeting needs. And at the same time, building more dams with climate change impacts coming down the pike might not lead to more benefits. So the river might not be tamed, but it could be ruined. And this is something that really concerns me, whether the current state of the Mekong and its ecology and its provisions to the people. Again, it's the largest river system in the world with a single freshwater fish catch, 2.6 million tons a year. North America's rivers and lakes, all of them combined, do 13 times less than that.
Wow.
And I think that dams and climate change combined have ruined that fish catch. To what degree, we're not quite sure. And whether this year is a new normal or kind of an anomaly because of this El Nino pattern, we'll have to wait until next year to see. But there are a lot of signals that even when I was writing the book and that I thought wouldn't manifest for years to come are happening now. And very clearly showing that the river might have had reached its ecological tipping point, that that it cannot bounce back. And this has me very concerned. So, you know, I call the book Last Days of the Mighty Mekong, thinking that we're in the last days of its mightiness. We're in it now, and they will last longer. But that's a title that I came up with years ago, and this book came out over a year ago, and much has changed in the region over the last year, surprisingly so, that perhaps indeed it is here and now, and maybe the Mekong is mighty no longer.
Definitely. Well, Brian, thank you so much for talking to us about your book and your broader intimate knowledge of one of the most vibrant river systems in the world. Stick around quickly to share your recommendations. But first, I just want to thank our listeners for always listening to us. Remind folks to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Belt and Road Pod. Brian, thanks so much for chatting. That was really awesome.
Yeah, this is a great time, Juliet. I'm looking forward to making my recommendation. I have it ready.
All right, go for it.
So between the talk at Berkeley and in this podcast, I read the book The Overstory, which, you know, a lot of people have been reading and talking about, the connection between man and trees. And it just entirely changed my perspective on our connection to nature and the ecology around us. And I can't recommend it more. I mean, I wrote a book on the connection between a river and people, but I don't feel like I get into that deep kind of psychological connection that the author does in The Overstory. So I not only recommend the book, but I recommend somebody to write either a fiction book or a nonfiction book about why rivers as a concept are so important to us and why we are also so important to rivers and the connection between.
That's great. I haven't seen that yet. That sounds wonderful. I recommend Milton Osborne's The Mekong. It's a classic book on the river. And it's called The Mekong, Turbulent Past, Uncertain Future. Not so different from the title of your book, but I think that it's a book that starts off talking about the French explorers that were kind of trying to come in the colonial era and their efforts and failures to kind of navigate, even just to navigate the Mekong from the start in Vietnam all the way up into China. It's a really great, you would call it a travelogue or a history, but it's a great book. It's a really good read. Brian, thanks again. Thanks for taking time.
Yeah. Happy to do this, Juliet. Take care.
All right, take care.